one of the oft-repeated quips in UU circles, although I imagine it extends beyond us as well, is that if you do something twice, you've established a tradition. I may be doing just that with this sermon today. Well, on the last Sunday in October 1 year ago here, I gave a sermon on the life and death of Michael Servetus, whose memory we have already honored. Servetus is primarily remembered as the 16th century Spanish physician and medical researcher, known in our circles, as you saw, as our first Unitarian martyr, burned at the stake in Geneva, Switzerland in 1553, in late October, at the hands of John Calvin, for his religious writings challenging the doctrine of the Trinity. So, here's the possible tradition part. I thought, well, maybe I will try using the last Sunday in October to highlight the life and the importance of a particular important individual, significant individual, in our Unitarian or Universalist stories. So my second annual UU Heritage Sunday sermon, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the life of the 18th century British scientist, political philosopher, linguist, and Unitarian minister, Joseph Priestley. Now, I would classify this kind of sermon as an eat your vegetables sermon. Remember, your parents used to say, eat your vegetables, they're good for you, they make you healthy and make you grow. Remember, that's what they said when they wanted you to eat your peas or your corn or your broccoli. This stuff is good for you. Well, this stuff is good for you if you're going to place yourself within the Unitarian Universalist liberal religious tradition, or if you're considering doing so. And as those of you who are vegetarians will attest, you can have a very nourishing four-course meal with vegetables, so let's hope that's the case. While they lived in different centuries and in different countries, there is an interesting parallel between Servetus and Priestley. It's in that the way in which they are primarily known in the wider world has actually very little to do with their religion and their religious opinions. Servetus, as just mentioned, is primarily known in the annals of medical history as someone who made some of the very early and very significant discoveries about the circulation of the blood. And Priestley is mostly known in the scientific community as the discoverer, actually he was the co-discoverer, of oxygen. So while we regard these two gentlemen as central figures in our religious story, their greater claim to fame really lies in other areas. Back to 1 year ago for a minute, those of you who were here may remember that I started off my Servetus sermon as if I were writing a screenplay for a movie about his life and talking about how I would film the opening or how I would make the opening scene go. And it was the description, Steve's already read it, of Servetus being led to his death by burning at the stake as dawn broke over 16th century Geneva. I'm going to try to see if I can do the same thing with Priestley and maybe get away with it one more time. And this scene also involves a fire. And while it does not cost Priestley his life, as it did with Servetus, it does a great deal of damage to his livelihood and to his well-being. So let's roll the tape and see how this would go. This time, you start with a blank screen. The words say, Birmingham, England, July 1791. First shot we make is from the outside through a living room window, and we see this rather professorial-looking 58-year-old Joseph Priestley and his wife Mary, who are spending an evening at home, which lets you know that we UUs have our very own Mary and Joseph. We then do a quick interior scan of the Priestley home, which includes his study with volumes of books, and then his laboratory where he conducts his various kinds of experiments. You look through the shop, through the living room window, shows the Unitarian church next door where Priestley is also the minister. And we're going to focus in on the Priestley faces as they become rather concerned because off in the distance they are hearing noises and voices and angry crowd noises. Crowd noises get closer and closer and closer, and then we hear broken glass and torches come flying through their window and set their house on fire, And they look over and they see that the church is also being torched in the same way. They grab whatever few belongings they can get. They head out their back door. And then we see them traveling to London, where they take refuge with friends. Here we'll put in a scene where Mary and Joseph talk about their four grown children and wonder what their fate will be, as well as their own, in the aftermath of this disaster. Then the screen is going to say 2 years later. And we see the Priestleys setting sail from England, April of 1794, for the new land of hope and promise, which the Europeans call America. They speak of joining their two grown sons who have preceded them on their own voyage to America a few months earlier and with whom they hope to settle. And the rest of my movie is going to be kind of a combination of prequel and sequel, which show all the stuff that led up to that time where they where their house gets burned down, and then we'll show some of what happens after they get to America, where Priestley lived out the remainder of his life. Well, I'm going to hit a few of the high points of that life in a few minutes. To give us a framework for this thing, though, I'd like to point to three components that I see as giving Priestley's life its fullness. Maybe sound like a rather unlikely combination at first hearing, as they are science, politics, and religion. Science, politics, and religion. Now, I would call these three things the priestly trinity, but I wouldn't want such a devout Unitarian as Priestley was to go flipping around in his grave, so I'm going to call them the priestly triangle instead. Three sides to a priestly triangle. We'll revisit that a little bit later. Let's take a run at the priestly bio first. This is kind of the peas and carrots parts of this thing. He was born in the town of Leeds, 1733. His mother died when he was 6 years old. No doubt this was a very painful loss for the young boy, but it also had its fortuitous side in that his financially strapped father sent him off to live with an aunt whose family were people of means and who could afford to pay for the education of their uncommonly bright and uncommonly precocious nephew. Bright and precocious in the sense that by the age of 16, he had mastered several languages, including Greek and Hebrew, and he was considering a career in the ministry. He was, that is to say, the kind of kid who makes his elders proud, and his young contemporaries hate him for being so good and so smart. Anyway, he studies theology, he studies religion, he prepares for, he very briefly for a time enters the Calvin-based Presbyterian ministry. But as he continues his study of theology, his study of religion, he comes to find that his religious ideas and his beliefs are moving in a progressively liberal direction. He comes to see that he's in basic agreement with the proponents from the Free Church Unitarian wing of the Protestant Reformation, with their emphasis upon the life and teachings of Jesus as the basis of human salvation, and not his death to supposedly deliver humanity from the state of original sin. In fact, later in his life, a number of years later, he would publish a book, one of the many volumes of books he published. He publishes a book called The Corruptions of Christianity, in which he held that the corruptions were the doctrines and the dogmas of the Christian faith who actually obscured who the person of Jesus really was. This was a theme that Thomas Jefferson would pick up on when he and Priestley much later became friends here in America. It was what led to Jefferson's writing the Jefferson Bible. So much of Priestley's career is taken up being a minister, being an academic, teaches languages at various universities, pastors Unitarian churches as they're being established in England in the wake of the Protestant Reformation. He and Mary raised their four kids. He lived, that is to say, a pretty conventional life that seemed to always be full of unconventional ideas. Kind of the way I think a good number of us Jews live. Conventional lives with unconventional ideas. Unlike the quixotic and sometimes bizarre behaving Servetus, Priestley led a pretty safe and secure existence up to a point, as we've already seen. And it was in the course of this conventional life of unconventional ideas that Priestley met another person of unconventional ideas, in the person of Benjamin Franklin. Franklin made a visit to London in 1766. So you had these sort of two inquiring minds, two very eclectic minds kind of meet and they really click. I think that'd make a good movie scene showing Priestley and Franklin meeting up together. By now, Franklin had already kind of done, he'd already done this thing with the kite and figured out what electricity was, and he regaled Priestley with the stories of his various other kinds of experiments. And this all served to push Priestley's ever precocious mind in still another direction, direction of scientific inquiry and the use of the scientific method when it comes to investigating the world of nature and natural processes. So adding to his credentials of minister and linguist, Priestley now becomes a largely self-educated scientist. Now, natural science was such a young field in those days, there are actually very few established credentialing bodies that would say who's an official scientist and who's not. I guess in those days, if you wanted to be a scientist, you just set yourself up a lab and started doing your experiments, and you were a scientist. But Priestley was actually able to get so many early experiments published in a few fledgling scientific journals, and in so doing, so he made a name for himself in what was still this very young field of inquiry, while still earning his living as a minister and a professor. And in 1774, 8 years after Franklin had first turned him on to science, Priestley was able to isolate the element of oxygen. And when he published his discovery, he learned that a French scientist by the name of Antoine Lavoisier had been conducting similar experiments, so he and Priestley had to share the credit for that discovery. But it's a discovery, what I find more intriguing, is one that Priestley made 2 years before this. I don't think it should go unnoticed. He was living back in his hometown of Leeds, teaching and being a minister, and he lived next to a brewery. And he noticed, living next to this brewery, that these certain gases would get emitted into the air from time to time, and some of these gases would settle to the ground, and the rest of them would kind of blow away. And he was trying to figure out, what is this heavier gas that's settling down while the rest of the gases are blowing on? And he found and isolated what later we call carbon dioxide, discovered carbon dioxide, called it heavy gas. And he figured out a way to create this gas in his laboratory, and then I guess tinkering around with it a little more, he found out that when he dissolved this heavy gas into water, it gave the water a very tangy, tingly kind of a taste, which is to say, he invented the carbonization of water, for which this got him elected to the French Academy of Sciences. 1772. So you got to think about that for a minute. The man who brought Unitarianism to America also made the discovery that eventually led to the creation of Coca-Cola and our other carbonated beverages. I'm not sure where to go with that, so I'm just going to let it sit there. Other than to say, you know, next time you take a big sip of soda or any other kind of carbonated drink, you know, if it makes you belch or something, you can thank Mr. Priestley for that. Well, it may well have been his ongoing contacts with the French scientists that made Priestley aware of the stirrings of democratic ferment in France, just as he had heard about it from Franklin some years prior. And France had all led up to the French Revolution in 1787 and the years thereafter. And as I said, he was hearing from his old friend Franklin about this democratic experiment that was happening in America following a revolution on our own over here from Priestley's own country of England. Hearing all this, looking at all this, adding yet another dimension to his career, that of political philosopher, writer, and editor. So he issues forth a whole other trove of writing in which he defends the French and the American revolutions and calls for the end of the British monarchy. Or at least the end of any real political power being vested in the British throne. So now he's adding a kind of radical politics to all the other dimensions of his life, including his religiously unorthodox ways. And this is what finally gets us back to those Birmingham riots in the summer of 1791. If you look at that, study how they happened, we also learn that the manipulation of fear by persons in power is anything but a new phenomenon. What was initially passed off as random violence by a gang of hooligans eventually proved to be, upon further review, a deliberately instigated piece of action against Priestley and several of his like-minded contemporaries who also lived in Birmingham at the time. The British ruling class, consisting of those in high positions of power in both religious and political realms, were getting scared. They had their reasons. They had already lost their colony in America, and they had that little debate going on about, you know, who lost America. They had lost their colony in America, which significantly diminished the power which they held in the known world of that day. And now they look over just across the channel and they see this revolution going on in France, which puts an end effectively to the monarchy there. And they see that that revolution for a time even takes a very violent and bloody turn, you know, all those heads flying off when the guillotine was coming down. And they look at all this and they start spreading the story that we actually have right here in our midst, you know, Trouble River City, in this case, Birmingham, England. We've got right here a man who took the side of those dangerous radicals over there in America and who is even showing sympathy with those revolutionary terrorists just a few miles away in France. And besides all that, he is teaching a false religion that undermines the basic fabric of the faith that gives us our moral underpinnings as a nation. He may look like a harmless academic and a minister, but he's really an enemy of the state and an enemy of the faith. As was later discovered, he was a local Anglican archbishop in cahoots with the local magistrates who put that message out amongst the populace and then just waited to see what would happen, which was the Birmingham riots of the summer of 1791. As just noted, other members of Priestley's congregation and some of his like-minded contemporaries were also targets from this manufactured, or targets of this manufactured fear. All of which leads me to think, going back to my movie again, you could probably make a Priestley movie as a metaphor for our time. Well, Priestley went on then. He left the way. He wanted to find out a way to promote his religious views, and he knew he had to go live somewhere else, and so he headed off for America. In his final years in America, were not altogether happy ones. He and Mary settled and had a home built on land their sons had already come ahead and purchased just west of Philadelphia, Northumberland. One of the sons soon died. Tensions developed between Priestley and his other son. Their daughters had married and remained in England. Mary died only a few years after the two of them arrived here. So what you had by around the mid-1790s, you had a very lonely Joseph Priestley, his wife dead, his daughters on the other side of the ocean, one son died, and the other son from whom he is estranged. So he turns to his writings, his books, his friends, and as I say, he began to look for a way that he might promote some of the religious views that he'd been talking about over in England. And he looked for a platform. The only place he could find one was a Universalist church in Philadelphia. They gave him a public platform. In 1795, they gave him an invitation to deliver a series of lectures on liberal Christianity. And it was on the strength of these lectures that Priestley and some of his new friends and followers founded in the Philadelphia area in 1796 the first church in America to call itself a Unitarian church. Among those who occasionally worshiped in this church or visited Priestley were his old friend Benjamin Franklin, along with Thomas Jefferson, John Adams. Got invited down to Mount Vernon to visit Washington for a time. And so Unitarianism got a foothold in Philadelphia and the Washington area, thanks to Priestley, while it was also beginning to gather steam in the Congregational churches up here in New England. Priestley didn't do a whole lot with the church after he had founded. His health was failing. He died in 1804. One of our Unitarian Universalist geographical districts, or UUA, across the United States, divided up into various districts, the one that encompasses western Pennsylvania and some of that surrounding area is called the Joseph Priestley District to honor his memory. A couple more things. One of those debates that Unitarian historians like to get into from time to time, whether or not Priestley's church really was the first Unitarian church in America. Talk to some of the folks down at King's Chapel, they'll tell you another story. Because about 4 or 5 years before Priestley's Church was founded, a congregation down at Boston King's Chapel declared itself to be Unitarian in theology, and they changed the language in their prayer book to reflect that. But King's Chapel never put the actual name of Unitarian on their church. Priestley's was the first liberal religious congregation to call itself Unitarian by name. So, which one really was the first Unitarian church in America? Well, I report, you decide. So. Well, let me wrap this up for a few minutes. I want to go back to that priestly triangle I referred to earlier. Remember, science, politics, and religion. For seen in a certain light and understood in a certain way, I consider these three things to actually be the three sides of the triangle of religious liberalism itself. Let's quickly take them one at a time. For by science, I don't just mean the hard sciences. I don't even mean a particular field of study or activity, but rather I mean, on the science piece of this triangle, the very spirit of inquiry, the spirit of discovery, the spirit of always looking for new things that will enhance and enrich our lives. I mean maintaining an open and inquisitive and ever-curious attitude towards our world and our universe, and how it works and what it can teach us about who we are and how we got here and how we best live within the larger web and fabric of life itself. And I further mean maintaining such an attitude free of any kind of preordained doctrine or dogma that human beings have devised. I mean having the freedom to explore the world, the natural world, the world of people and events and ideas, all of that, as it is, with all the knowledge and lessons that our world, our universe, has to offer. And when I say free of doctrine or dogma, I'm not just talking about religious dogma or doctrine. I think it has been the presence over the past several years of a well-established economic and political dogma, for example, that has prevented us as a society and a nation from really coming to terms with the effects and the dimensions of global warming. Second side of our priestly triangle, religious liberalism, is politics. And here again, I'm using the term in a very broad sense, well above and beyond political activity, some of which is noble and some of which is horrible. Politics is actually and ultimately about how power operates in any human group or society or community or nation. It's about how such power is used for good or ill in human society. It's about who possesses what kind of power and how they exercise it. It's about who has access to power and who doesn't. And Priestley was wise enough to see how a more democratic way of dealing with the workings of power in a nation state was beginning to replace the more absolutist methods of a monarchy. So I think one of the ways we honor his legacy today is by being active participants in the democratic processes that are now available to us. Then the third one, religion. Third side of my liberal religious triangle. Again, we switch with the other two, using the term in a very broad sense. For I mean religion as a search for meaning and purpose and value and spiritual depth in living. I mean it as cultivating a sense of awe and wonder and mystery at this world, universe, in which we've been placed for a time. I mean religion as that which gives us our sense of relationship, our sense of connection, both with our fellow human beings and with all of life itself. Understood this way, it is religion, what I take to be the best sense of the word, that anchors the triangle. Scientific inquiry can explain to us why a sunset looks the way it does, why the various colors are being shown by the way they're being filtered through the atmosphere of the clouds. And they can tell us why stars are arrayed in a particular way, from the point of view of our particular planet. But there's something deeper within us that gives us our sense of awe, or mystery, or wonder, when we look at a stunning sunset, or a vast array of stars. I call this our religious, or our spiritual impulse. The impulse that looks beyond ourselves with some sense of connection with that which is greater than ourselves, however we may name it. Scientific inquiry can tell us about how we got here, how we evolved into the human creatures that we are. It can explain why we are the mortal creatures we are, who only get a certain amount of time to live. The search to discover why we are here and how we find meaning in the face of our mortality, again, comes from that deeper impulse, that religious or spiritual impulse. And if politics is ultimately about how power works in a society, it is religion, again in its best and most noble sense, that can tell us how power ought to operate and ought to work in a society in order to further promote what our Unitarian Universalist principles call justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. So those three worlds in which Priestley moved, the worlds of science and learning, of politics, and of an enlightened form of religion, are what gave his life, difficult and troubled as it was at times, its wholeness and its meaning. And these are the very same worlds that beckon us to greater levels of wholeness and meaning in our lives as well. And we should be thankful to this spiritual ancestor of ours for helping us and helping to show us the way. So, I think we're ready for our closing hymn. You've had your vegetables. You can now get your coffee. Closing hymn is The Growing Light, number 345.